Hello and welcome to another episode of Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis. I'm Lita. Ron is not with us today. And as we are taping, he is out preparing to compete in the U.S. Nationals as a para archer. And we send him our best wishes along the way.
Yep. Good luck, Ron. And I'm Jean Marie.
Collectively, we're the host of Podcast DX. On today's show, we're speaking with Dr. Eugenie Hsu. Dr. Eugenie Hsu is a psychologist. She currently resides in California. Oh, we're jealous.
We're jealous of the weather.
The weather is pretty nice.
We're from Chicago. Eugenie is a clinical psychologist by profession, and she lives in the San Francisco Bay Area with her husband and two children. In 2011, when her son was 8 years old, he was diagnosed and treated for a craniopharyngioma brain tumor. Grateful for his survival, but distressed by the many challenges he suffered in the aftermath of the tumor and surgery, Eugenie became focused upon finding solutions and treatments to improve his and other survivors' quality of life. She's joining us today to talk about her son's health journey.
Good morning, Dr. Hsu.
Hi, you can call me Eugenie.
Okay. Hi, Eugenie. We're Hi. Also very jealous of the architecture in your area because, oh, just beautiful architecture. And one of my favorite stores, which temporarily closed, but I think is back open, Gump's.
Oh, the seafood.
No, not Gump's. Bubba Gump's.
Oh,
no,
that's down south.
The department store.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I'm located right north of Berkeley, so we're probably we're about 10 miles to San Francisco.
Okay.
But it's all kind of all connected, the Bay Area.
Right. Eugenie, could you please tell us what is a craniopharyngioma brain tumor?
Okay. It's quite a mouthful.
It is.
Yeah, craniopharyngioma is a rare non-malignant brain tumor. And it develops embryonically, so it's very slow growing. It's developed before the child is born, and it's diagnosed in both kids and adults. There are about 350 cases, new cases, that are diagnosed every year in the U.S., so it's considered rare. They say it's a 1 in a million chance you will get a craniopharyngioma. And the tumor itself resides in a very specific area of the brain, the central part of the brain, actually, and it affects the hypothalamic, pituitary, and optic nerve areas of the brain.
Okay.
I don't know if you want to know more about it. It's considered benign. They call it a benign brain tumor. So that means it's non-cancerous. It doesn't spread to other parts of the body. But it can reoccur. So there are some people who've had it reoccur multiple times and have had to have, 10, 15 surgeries to remove it. And so it's got a high survival rate, but it is very impactful on the quality of life because of where it resides in the brain. It's sort of prime real estate.
For sure.
Right, for sure.
And how old was your son when he was first diagnosed, and what symptoms first led you to seek out medical care for him?
So he was 8 years old when he was first diagnosed. And in retrospect, of course, we can always look back and look for clues. Mm-hmm. And actually, I did have some pretty strong clues, but there were reasons why it took a long time to get diagnosed. So probably when he was about six, he started to have very occasional headaches. And I mean, to my knowledge, maybe once or twice a year. So even though I thought it was a little strange that a six-year-old kid would have a headache, I didn't pay too much attention to it because it was only once or twice a year. What was more telling or more distressing to me at about that age was that I noticed that he really wasn't growing very much height-wise. He was a really big baby. He was 9.5 pounds when he was born.
Oh, that's a big baby.
And my husband's tall. My husband's 6'2", and I'm average. I'm 5'5". So because he was so big at birth, he did keep on his growth curve for a while, But then, you know, starting at about first or second grade, he started to slow down. I actually was concerned enough to take him to see his pediatrician. And at the time, I think his growth, he used to be in the 70th percentile for height, and then it fell down to about the 30th percentile. And one really painful thing I remember was the doctor actually asked me, is he having headaches in the morning? And at the time, I really focused on the morning part of it, and he wasn't having headaches in the morning exclusively. I think he had been having, a headache here or there, but not in the morning. So I answered the question, no, he's not having headaches in the morning. He's had a headache here and there, but not in the morning. And then I said, why do you ask? He said, oh, and he whispered this because my son was in the room. He said, oh, because if he was having headaches in the morning, I would be worried about a brain tumor. And he kind of whispered it. And as soon as I heard that, I immediately dismissed it because, of course, I didn't want to think that my kid was, having headaches because of a brain tumor. And anyway, the long story is short is that it wasn't diagnosed until his headaches became more severe. And then that doctor diagnosed him with migraines, which was also wrong. Finally, when his symptoms were so severe, he was having problems staying awake and starting to have some cognitive problems. That doctor referred him to a neurologist, and he was sent for an emergency CT scan. And that's how his tumor was diagnosed.
Okay, so the definitive diagnosis didn't come until like age 8 after the CT scan.
Yeah, he was sent for an emergency CT scan because the neurologist who finally saw him after all his lab tests came back normal looked into his eyes and could tell that he had this condition called papilledema, which means that you can't see the optic nerve because there's something blocking it. And that's when she probably already knew at that point that he had a brain tumor. So she sent him to this emergency CT scan, and 2 hours later he was diagnosed with a brain tumor.
How not to get off script, but what were your feelings and thoughts at that point?
Well, it was interesting because I remember I work or I've very recently retired from working at that very hospital. So I work as a psychologist. And so I was at work when this happened. This happened on a Tuesday, and it was actually the very last day of summer, right before he was to start third grade. So since I was at work, my husband took him to see the neurologist and then to the CT scan. And I just remember, they went to get the scan, and then they were told, go and have lunch, and then we'll call you. So they went down the street to get some burritos or something. And then they were called and said, come back to the emergency room right away. And so they did. And I think my husband was still kind of probably a little shocked or not really like thinking clearly, like, what is this about? It actually didn't occur to me until I was sitting in the waiting room. They told us to go to neurosurgery. Now, I should have been clued in. Like, if the doctor tells you to go to neurosurgery, that's a pretty strong clue that there's something wrong, seriously wrong, right? But I think I was just in a denial state, and I just thought, okay, I know he has hydrocephaly. That was explained to us in the emergency department. Your son has hydrocephaly, which means that, his cerebral spinal fluid was backing up and putting pressure on his brain. Now, for some reason in my mind, I worked out, oh, okay, maybe we're in neurosurgery because they need to release the pressure from whatever's, causing it. It did not occur to me to ask myself, why does he have hydrocephaly? And of course, I was probably just not wanting to think about it. And it wasn't until we met with the surgeon. And he said, your son has a brain tumor, a mass on his brain that's blocking the third ventricle, which is why all the fluid from his brain is backing up and putting pressure on his skull. And that's why he was having severe headaches with vomiting. So yes, I was shocked.
Well, yeah, and I think we've heard over and over again with people dealing with a new diagnosis or a new diagnosis for their children or a loved one, that you do go through like the same stages that you would go through with grief. And so it makes a lot of sense. And sometimes we, you know, we recommend that you bring someone with you who's not, you know, has a more objective view of things and mm-hmm. won't be going through that same shock that you are, so that, you know, they can make note of everything that's going on, because it can be overwhelming. And it sounds like, you know, obviously it was. How is this condition typically treated? And when did you and your husband and your son's healthcare team decide that removing the tumor was the best course of action for him? And what was the recovery like for him and for you guys?
Yeah, so the tumor is typically treated with either surgery with or without radiation. So what we did was, because there was, it was, you know, it was a pretty urgent matter. I mean, his, you know, the fact that he had hydrocephaly meant that, you know, there was a lot of pressure in his head. And so we needed to act quickly, but it wasn't such an emergency that we needed to, you know, have his head cut open at that very second. So we had a torturous 16 days between the time that we had the tumor diagnosed and the time he had his brain surgery appointment, or, you know, yeah, his brain surgery appointment, I guess you could call that. So after consulting with the neurosurgery team at my hospital, and we were sort of fortunate in that we learned that the neurosurgeon who treated my son was actually world-renowned. He was board certified in 5 countries, I believe.
Wow.
And he would travel all over the world doing brain surgeries and teaching. His name's Dr. Pang, and his team of doctors, we call them Dr. Pang and the gang. So anyway, so Dr. Pang did the surgery, and there's, you know, many different kinds of surgical routes. Well, there's 2 main ones, I think, that are used for this tumor. So if you think about it, this is how we learned about the tumor. It was actually very alarming. So when he sat down to explain to us about this tumor, he had a model of a head.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you know, the things that you would see in medical school where, you know, you'd have the head and then you could take off a piece and it would be removing part of the skull. And then you could see the different brain anatomy parts. So the way he explained it to us was he took off the skull and then he started to take off other pieces in the brain. And he kept on taking off parts until he got to the very middle of the brain. So imagine it's the center of the earth.
Right.
And then
right.
He says, this is where your son's tumor is located. And I thought, what the hell? How are we going to get that out?
Right.
And so basically his tumor was so large because it was completely blocking the third ventricle. So it was 3x4x5 centimeters. He said that, you know, he had to do this thing called a craniotomy,
mm-hmm.
which is where they basically cut a window.
And especially in such a little tiny skull. Right. That is,
yeah. So they cut a window in the head, right on the forehead. Right, they cut this window, and then, oh, sorry, I didn't do that right. They first do an ear to ear incision from ear to ear.
Oh, right.
And then they pull down the scalp. It's kind of gross, I know. They pull down the scalp to reveal the skull. Then they cut a window in the skull, and then they go in through the skull all the way into the brain. So
do
that
they
was
have
called,
to, do they have to move,
craniotomy.
Do they have to move the brain tissue?
Yeah, she's going to explain.
Okay.
How to go through the lobes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Some of the other surgeries are done they're done endonasally. So they actually go in through the nose. But my son's tumor was too large
mm-hmm.
to remove that way. So they had to go into the craniotomy. Anyway, so that's how they did it. Some people end up having a partial resection, so they don't take out the entire tumor because there are some very delicate areas of the brain that you do not want to damage. And our surgeon was more aggressive, so he took out all of it. So the surgery was very long. It was 14 hours long, and he went in, you know, early in the morning and got out at midnight or something like that. And the recovery was longer, so he was in the ICU for 6 weeks. It sort of became our second home. My husband and I just took turns spending the night there. every night. We actually had a nickname for the ICU, the PICU. We called it the Prison for Ill Children and Their Parental Units because we were there for so long.
Yeah.
But we you know, all in all, I mean, it was not a fun experience, but we were very blessed to have great doctors and nurses take care of my son.
That's good.
And the main effect of the tumor, the primary effect, which led to other effects, was that it caused him to lose all of his hormone functioning. So I don't think I mentioned this earlier, but the area of the brain where the tumor is located affects his pituitary gland, his hypothalamus, and his optic nerve. And it, or maybe I did mention that, it basically leads to complete loss of hormones. So that
permanent?
Was a big, big loss.
Oh.
Now, the reason why he was in the hospital for so long, there are several reasons, but the main reason that it just dragged on and on was because he had a he had and still has a condition called diabetes insipidus. It has no relationship to sugar diabetes. And what it is he no longer makes antidiuretic hormone, which is desmopressin, or vasopressin is the actual hormone. And that means that he cannot regulate, his body does not regulate the fluid balance. So he has to take a replacement hormone called desmopressin. And if he didn't have that medicine, he would basically urinate out everything, all of his fluid, and he would become desiccated. Now, if that's not complicated enough to deal with, because of the damage to the hypothalamus, which I'll get into a little bit more later, he also has completely lost his thirst mechanism.
Oh my gosh.
So most of us, you know, if you became dehydrated, you would feel thirsty,
right,
and then you would drink.
Right.
Imagine if you're losing all of your bodily fluids because you don't have, you know, the hormone to keep it in, and you feel no thirst. It's very dangerous.
Sure. Yeah.
So it was very hard to regulate his electrolytes, for that matter, because his fluid balance was all off.
Oh, wow.
And he had no way to tell us that he was thirsty.
Wow.
So that's all done through measuring the blood and measuring sodium levels. But the other thing that happens after brain surgery is this thing called cerebral salt wasting. So the body dumps out all the salt, and it's just a very, very difficult thing to navigate. So that was one of the main reasons it was very, very difficult to stabilize him. And there are many other reasons, but that was the main one.
Sounds terrible.
Well, yeah, it sounds definitely challenging, to say
that
the
was
least.
Challenging, yeah.
Yes.
And then I guess I should also mention that then he had to go back to the hospital, because after he came home, after 6 weeks, he lost a lot of his vision as well. So he's pretty much blind in one eye. And he came home and he slipped and fell headfirst into a stationary table. And of course, that was super scary for us because, you know,
sure,
they even told us he should not ever bump his head. It's dangerous. And it was like the worst fall you can imagine, headfirst into a table.
Mm.
4 weeks later, he started to act kind of strange and woozy. And was, you know, we had to call the ambulance again. Found out he had a severe subdural hematoma. He had a brain bleed. So then he had to have emergency surgery, and that was over Thanksgiving week. So he had to have another surgery. So that's two surgeries in less than 3 months.
Yeah.
And anyway, that hospital stay was actually much less. It was only a week.
Okay.
But anyway, in the aftermath, he had to, you know, go through long rehab. He had physical and occupational speech therapy. He's had to make a lot of accommodations at school for his special education needs, for his learning issues and visual impairment. Of course, there's that extreme measuring of his fluid intake. I used to have to measure every drop of water he drank and every drop of pee he peed every single
wow.
day.
Wow.
For years we did this.
Oh, wow.
And get his blood checked in the laboratory of the hospital frequently. And, you know, we even had a system where we didn't want to have to carry one of those pee hats with us if we went
right.
out in public, because that's
right.
kind of a hassle. So we had a system where he would count the number of seconds he peed, and we would estimate how much urine output it was.
Okay. That was a clever way to deal with it. Yeah.
Right. I'm not sure how accurate it was, but we had to do that. And then, of course, he had to have frequent laboratory, you know, tests. He had to undergo sleep studies. He had to use a CPAP and a BiPAP machine because of the damage to the hypothalamus that caused sleep irregularities. His diet was a huge deal. Doctor's appointments, MRIs, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
Wow. It sounds like you've all been through an awful lot, and I think he's lucky to have you as a parent, because you know, it sounds like, you know, even though it's been an extreme situation, it sounds like you've dealt with it with aplomb, and just
you rose to the challenge.
You did.
Do you have other children, did you have other children at the time?
Yeah, Alex, my son, has a little sister who's 2 years younger.
Okay.
So you were going through all this along with having to deal with your other daughter at home.
Yeah. Yeah, she's a trooper too, and she's been a very supportive sister to her brother, and I think it's made her grow up pretty fast.
To
be mature and
right.
And we're lucky. She had a lot of friends, so when we were going to the hospital, she would have like extra sleepovers with her friends and stuff.
That's
like that.
Good. Bonus. Yeah. Yes. Bonus. Eugenie, I understand that because of the damage to that the tumor did to his hypothalamus, your son also began to gain weight, and that he gained weight rapidly during the next 5 years. How does the weight gain differ from weight gain contributed to overeating and lack of physical exercise?
The weight gain is different because he's gaining it for a different reason. So he has a condition that's called hypothalamic obesity. And I'm just going to call it HO from now on because it's a little bit easier to say. So,
and we can pronounce that.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's the hypothalamus is a very small area of the brain right next to the pituitary gland. And it basically controls homeostasis in our bodies, right? So it's a regulatory organ. And so it will tell us if we're thirsty or hungry. It will regulate our temperature. It'll regulate energy, and it regulates sleep. So those are all very, very basic functions that we all have. But his was damaged because of the size of the tumor and the aggressiveness of the surgery. So that left him with sort of a malfunctioning homeostasis system. And as I mentioned earlier, he lost his thirst mechanism. Mm-hmm. Now, it did the opposite to hunger, unfortunately. So it made him extremely hungry, and it made it so that he was not able to tell if he was full. So what would happen is he would eat, and, you know, just a little while later, he'd be hungry again. Now, most of us would eat a big meal and we'd feel pretty satisfied, and we wouldn't necessarily need to eat an hour later or a half hour later, but he would because he was always hungry. So the obesity problem was just more, to me, I mean, in my mind and in our case, and it's different in everyone's case, but in our case, the obesity problem and the weight gain was more secondary to the appetite problem. And this is called hyperphagia, which is an excess appetite with poor satiety. And what would happen with this is that since he came home from the hospital, he was hungry all the time, and he would eat, and then he would feel hungry again and want to eat again. And one night I even caught him, let me just say, we figured this out pretty quickly, so we had to lock up our kitchen and prevent him from eating all the time.
Wow.
And he was so motivated to eat in spite of our locking. One night I caught him, so he's 8. I remember he fell and hit his head.
Right.
He required a second brain surgery. But one night I woke up and I saw him on the counter trying to climb on top of the refrigerator because we had put some food out of his reach up on the refrigerator.
Oh, jeez.
Saw it. So I saw him doing that. Another night I saw him, we had put a lock on the refrigerator that was a combination lock. I saw him standing there trying to figure out the code. How long had he been standing there? I have no idea, but he was motivated. So anyway, his obsession to eat and his hunger was a huge problem for us and for him, and we were afraid that he would just eat and eat and eat. And so we ended up, having to watch him very carefully. Now, because we did that from a very young age, I mean, from the time he came from the hospital, we figured it out very soon. Not a lot of families necessarily do that. We were able to control his weight gain to a degree. Like he didn't blow up to become, 100 pounds overweight, for example. He was still o overweight, but it came at the price of our social life. We had no social life. We couldn't have people over for dinner. We couldn't go to potlucks. We couldn't go to parties. We could, we couldn't because it would be horrible. We'd have to police him, and it was very stressful, as you can imagine. But the thing that was the worst of all, that was already hard enough, but we also knew that we couldn't keep it up because what are we going to do when he's 20? You know, watch him all the time, follow him around like a little toddler, having someone police him, that was just completely unsustainable.
Well, and how common is HO? Is it do people that are is it like is it something that affects the general population as well?
No, it's hypothalamic obesity is specifically has to do with when you have an injury to the hypothalamus, then you have an obesity syndrome called hypothalamic obesity. It's not even that 100% of people with craniopharyngioma get it. It's probably, they estimate about 50% of people with the tumor end up having it. And it has everything to do with whether or not the hypothalamus is injured. So if the surgeon is less aggressive or the tumor wasn't growing on the hypothalamus, it's very likely that somebody can have craniopharyngioma and not end up with hypothalamic obesity.
And was the surgeon so aggressive because he wanted to ensure that the entire tumor was removed and would hopefully not regrow, and has it regrown?
I think this surgeon was a little bit more old school. So what I've learned is that in the years, more recent times, there's been a lot of conversation among neurosurgeons about what is the best way to treat a tumor like craniopharyngioma. And it's a little bit more common nowadays to be less aggressive. Sure, there's a chance that the tumor couldn't regrow, but it's sort of like, what's worse? Is it worse to have another surgery, possibly have another surgery if it regrows? Or is it worse to, take a chance and, remove the whole tumor but end up with serious consequences afterwards. So for whatever reason, our surgeon just was a more aggressive surgeon. He took it out and, fortunately, knock on wood, it's been almost 10 years now, his tumor has not regrown. So we're very glad about that.
Well,
That's
that's good.
wonderful.
Yeah, that's great. Eugenie, are there any other treatments available for hypothalamic obesity disease?
There are drugs that treat HO, but not very effectively. So, for example, there's a report that was published by the International Hypothalamic Obesity Disorders Registry, and the report basically showed that, with all the different treatments that are available to treat obesity, there's a pretty it's really shown that these treatments are pretty lacking in effectiveness. A lot of them have undesirable side effects. So there's no gold standard treatment to date. And there is nothing to date that is FDA approved for HO. So that's a problem. And that's more, I'm talking about more like drug treatment and things like that. In terms of diet, there are people who have been much more successful with reducing the weight gain. So, keeping the weight from going up and up and up. And some people have even lost weight, although permanent weight loss is very, very difficult to attain, even for people who don't have a rare obesity disorder. They do this by eating much lower in carbohydrates.
Okay.
So some people will just cut out all sugar, all refined sugar, and just eat much lower in carbohydrates. So they might be eating like 50 to 100 grams a day of carbohydrates,
okay,
which is very little.
Right. So Eugenie, how at that time when he was eight, and you found out that he had HO, how did you and your healthcare team decide to choose to treat your son's condition then? And now that he's a young adult, how does he self-regulate his appetite?
Okay.
And is he able to?
Yes. Okay. Those two-part question. Yeah.
Yes.
So in terms of treating the HO, like I said, there's no treatment for it, really.
Right.
So we were kind of left to our own devices. And I think because we, you know, we, as you can probably tell, my husband and I are very proactive.
Mm-hmm.
So I think our healthcare team could see that we were already doing what we could. You know, we were locking up all the food. We actually got some very poor advice from some of the doctors when he was in the hospital because he had extremely high triglycerides. Like, I don't think anyone has ever heard of numbers this high. His triglycerides, which is part of his cholesterol panel, came in at, well, normal is under 100, I think. And his was 7,300.
Oh, Lord.
That's when everyone in the lab looks at each other and says,
what's wrong with the
equipment?
Yeah,
what's wrong with the equipment?
Yeah, they had to do the test several times, but it came back high every time. Yeah, his blood was pink. It looked like a strawberry ice cream. And so anyway, I think maybe based on that super high triglycerides and, you know, knowing that he was probably developing hypothalamic obesity, this is very early on in the hospital, they told us to have him eat a very low fat diet, very low fat. So, you know, we didn't know. We're like, okay. I mean, we've always just eaten whatever we wanted to in our house. We're a very food oriented family. So we're like, okay, I guess we have to do that. So we put him on this extremely low fat diet, which we call the no fun diet. And it was, gosh, I'm trying to remember, under 20 grams of fat a day.
Wow.
Yeah, so basically almost no fat. And he's a good kid. He cooperated, you know, the best he could with that. I also wrote down every single thing he ate. So I have journals that are every single meal he ate, had to count up the fat grams, made sure it was less than 20 grams of fat. Now, unfortunately, if you think about, well, if you can't eat fat, what can you eat?
Mm-hmm.
So we were eating, he was eating things like bagels,
yep, all carbs,
rice
all
crackers.
The time.
He was eating carbs.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until we were referred, finally I asked for us to get referred to UCSF, a very well-known endocrinologist named Dr. Robert Lustig, who is kind of famous for his, he's a big anti-sugar proponent. And anyway, he said, you guys are on the wrong diet. You know, fat's okay. People get mixed up between dietary fat and cholesterol. Anyway, so he said, you got to get them on a low carb diet. I'm like, oh, well, why didn't they tell us this? We've been eating, you know, low fat for 4 years. It was ridiculous.
Right, right.
Which was the wrong diet. Anyway, we switched over to the low carb diet. So that was the first positive step. Now, that helped, you know, keep his weight in a more reasonable level. But his hyperphagia was still raging, right? He was still eating a lot. And so what I did was I realized that there are hormones that he's not getting replaced.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that because he has panhypopituitarism, which means makes no hormones, that all the major hormones are going to get replaced. And indeed, most of them were getting replaced, right? So thyroid, growth hormone, sex hormone, antidiuretic hormone, stress hormones, those five hormones were being replaced. But I learned about another one called oxytocin. And oxytocin, most of us know as the hormone that is responsible for labor contractions, mm-hmm. right? Milk let down. Mm-hmm. A lot of people now know it as the love hormone or whatever you want to call it, the affection hormone. But I learned that oxytocin is another major hormone produced in the hypothalamus, released by the posterior pituitary gland. And what was so fascinating was when I looked up more on oxytocin, I was reading whatever I could in the research literature on it, I found that it actually, the functions of oxytocin perfectly matched my son's untreated symptoms.
Wow.
Because oxytocin was also responsible for appetite and metabolism, and also some, there's social functioning as well, when people think about oxytocin as the bonding hormone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when I found this out, I was kind of puzzled, like, why isn't oxytocin getting replaced? It just mm-hmm. seems like, well, I mean, all the other ones are getting replaced. Why wouldn't this one get replaced? Plus, it seems to be perfectly matched with my son's symptoms.
Right,
and my son's symptoms are not getting treated. So what is wrong with this picture?
Right.
Anyway, long story short, I decided I needed to find out how to get this replaced. And when I asked about it, you know, to be honest, when I asked his endocrinologist, I said, you know, what do you know about oxytocin? It seems like that should be something that should be getting replaced. Her answer was, oh, that's for labor contractions. You know, so like, you know, I was induced with oxytocin, right? When when I had my son, he was very late, because that's probably why he was huge. And they gave me Pitocin. Pitocin mm-hmm. is basically the same as oxytocin. So that's what most people know, oxytocin. But people didn't know, including doctors, including endocrinologists who specialize in hormones.
Wow.
Don't know about oxytocin. So anyway, I did a lot of reading on oxytocin. I started, you know, just went through all the articles I could find. And I started to contact the researchers who were writing these articles. And I was asking them about it. I finally got in touch with a doctor by the name of Jennifer Miller. She's at the University of Florida. And she's a champion in treating and doing research in Prader-Willi syndrome. So Prader-Willi syndrome is kind of like the phenotypic cousin to craniopharyngioma. This is a congenital chromosomal problem, syndrome that develops in 1 out of 15,000 births, I think. I think that's the statistic, I'm not incorrect. And they have a lot of similar problems because they also, these folks also in their development embryonically also end up having problems with the hypothalamus. So there's a lot of overlap between these two diseases. Anyway, Dr. Miller, I contacted her and asked her about oxytocin because she was doing research on it. And I told her, I really want my son to try this. And she mm-hmm. was willing to be his medical advisor. Even though I'm in California and she's in Florida and we've mm-hmm. never met, she agreed to kind of mentor me through it. So I found an endocrinologist in LA who was more progressive and was willing to prescribe it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beginning of our experimental treatment with oxytocin.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, and once again,
you have to be an advocate for your kids
son
and yourself.
Lucky to have you as his advocate because you did all that research and really sought out to improve his overall health. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Eugenie, I do have a question. How is the oxytocin administered? Is it a nasal spray or?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a nasal spray. It has to be compounded because it's not. You know, it's not available. It's not FDA approved. We're using it in a very off-label way.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's compounded at a compounding pharmacy.
And how long has he been on this?
5 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. And I was going to ask a question. I know there's been increased research about Pitocin being used to induce labor and its side effects. But I'm guessing that's because you're taking Pitocin on top of your normally produced oxytocin, that it can cause complications and that sort of thing. But how do they regulate how much oxytocin he is receiving?
Do you mean through the spray?
Yes.
Oh, he takes a very, very low dose. He takes 6 international units, a spray a day. And, you know, oxytocin's been very well studied and, you know, it's been used for a long time to induce labor.
Right.
That's administered through the IV. It's a very different thing.
Okay.
Right. And he's just taking a small dose, a very low dose of it. Now, the tricky thing about oxytocin is it's very difficult to measure. So like some of the other hormones that he takes, you know, we can do a thyroid panel and we can see what his thyroid levels are showing. It's not so easy to do that with oxytocin. Even researchers don't agree on what is the best way to measure it. And it's, I don't want to get into the weeds here, but it's a pulsatile hormone. So it kind of comes out at different times. And I don't know if there's really any way to measure it. Certainly not for clinical use. I think they even have difficulties measuring it in research.
Wow.
So it's all very experimental.
Okay. And when did you start to, did you see an immediate change in his symptoms and his, you know, overall behaviors? Yes.
Over-appetite?
Well, this is kind of a long story, but just to summarize, I would say, you know, it took us a while to figure out dosing because it's all individualized. We were just fooling around and trying, you know, we tried 9 units. We tried, I think we tried more, even maybe 20 units. We just kind of fooled around with different doses. And I believe we started it in May of 2016. I don't remember all my dates, but I'm going to say that maybe in July, the thing that stuck out to me that was super remarkable was this thing I call the HEFY. It's H-E-F-Y. It stands for half-eaten frozen yogurt. So we would occasionally take him to a frozen yogurt store down the street from where we live as for a treat. And the store happens to have sugar-free and fat-free frozen yogurt, which honestly sounds pretty terrible to me, but it was a treat to him. And so we would get him this frozen yogurt, and and he loved it, because it was like the only dessert thing he would get. And anyway, one day he got this frozen yogurt, and he ate about half of it, and then he said, "Oh, where's the garbage can?"
Oh.
And we were just all taken aback, like,
sure.
Well, what do you mean? Where's the garbage can? You're not going to eat that? Is there something wrong with it? He said, No, it's quite good. I'm just full. And we were all startled, like all of us were shocked. And I just sort of stared at him. And then I actually immediately snapped a picture of the frozen yogurt because I wanted to take a picture of this moment. This is like super remarkable.
Yeah, you wanted to have it bronzed.
We couldn't find a garbage can though. It was not garbage day. So he ended up walking around with that half eaten frozen yogurt all the way home. And by that time it was melted and then we threw it away at home. But that was the moment we thought something is going on here.
That's great.
But of course it did take us a long time to get him, you know, to kind of get him to a place where he could, you know, he could learn that he wasn't starving anymore, right? Because it was such a survival mechanism. Before the oxytocin, you know, he would scrounge around looking for food that was left out. He would hide it, stash it away for some other time, just like, you know, like a squirrel stashing away nuts in the winter for the winter, right? And it was a psychological thing, too. I think it wasn't only hunger. The hunger was definitely there. But even if he had food, he would probably think, well, how am I going to know I'm going to, you know, have food tomorrow or the next day? It's sort of like people who've starved or lived through a war just become hoarders, right?
Right.
It took a long time to kind of get it so that we could unlock the kitchen and allow him to, monitor his own food intake. I would say it took us a good year to kind of get things more normal. But your other question was, what does he do now?
Yes.
Yeah, so he's.
And is it something that he's able to control?
Yeah, I would say he's still not great around sugar. I mean, and I think that we have to acknowledge that sugar is a very powerful drug for all of us, right? And some of us have stronger sweet tooths than others. And I think that my son probably got his sweet tooth from his father because my husband has a pretty strong sweet tooth. So we still don't eat processed sugar in our house. We don't keep that around our house. I think if we did, we'd all probably be 10 pounds fatter. So we don't do that. We try to eat healthier, whole foods. I mean, it's not like we don't eat any snack foods, but we try to avoid a lot of snacky kinds of foods in the house. My son does like to cook now, so he has certain recipes that he likes to make that are special treats that he can have that are, not using refined flours, but he'll bake with almond flour or coconut flour. And then he uses a sweetener called erythritol. So he's pretty good with food now. He's, occasionally he included, we still overindulge at times, but it's, I would say the appetite is much more normal and everything is unlocked, of course.
Good.
That's great.
Good.
Yeah.
Eugenie, from your perspective as a psychologist, what role does mental health care play with a child living with HO?
Well, I think that, in my son's case, the hyperphagia really was such torture, Just imagine feeling hungry all the time and then having your parents lock food away so you can't get at it. And it's a terrible thing, first of all, as a mother, having to do that to a child. I mean, my instinct is I'm Chinese American, and my family, like a lot of other Chinese Americans and other Asian Americans that I know, very, very food oriented, and food is love, right? So to be generous with food is to be generous with love, and to not be generous with food feels like the opposite. So very, very hard to do that, but I had to do it for my son's health. And I think that he had developed quite a complex around food for obvious reasons. Now, that paired with the fact that our country, our society, is very fat phobic, there's a lot of discrimination against people who have more weight on their bodies than others. And if you put those two things together, HO is very cruel. It's a very cruel condition. So I think to answer your question about mental health, I do think it's helpful for people who are struggling with these kinds of issues to have somebody to talk to. I personally think the most helpful people to talk to are other people who are going through the same thing. So if anyone who's struggling can find a support group, find other people who understand them, who aren't going to judge them, that to me is the most helpful thing.
Yes, good advice.
And have you found groups on Facebook and or other forms of social media?
Yes, thank goodness for social media and for the internet. I was thinking how hard it must have been to go through these kinds of situations pre-internet. But yeah, we have found lots of support groups online through Facebook, and one specifically for craniopharyngioma, specific for HO. It's been wonderful actually being able to talk to other people, and I've even met some of these people in
Oh,
person.
nice.
So we have a craniopharyngioma California group, and before the pandemic we were going down to Los Angeles every summer and having a picnic down there, and that was really nice. I now belong I'm on the board of directors at a foundation that supports hypothalamic pituitary brain tumor survivors, and we've held conferences and Definitely the networking has been super helpful on an emotional support level as well as on a practical level.
That's wonderful. And Eugenie, what are some of the less obvious parts of your son's life that have been affected by the HO and his tumor and his, you know, that whole, his whole healthcare? Sorry, I'm having trouble speaking today. Yeah, Eugenie, what are some of the less obvious parts of your son's life that have been affected by his healthcare journey, by his HO perhaps?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the less obvious things are things that you can't see, which is, you know, I think a lot of it, you know, I think if you saw my son and you interacted with him, you would think, oh, he's a nice young man. You know, he's very friendly. He's, you know, he looks fine. He looks healthy. There's really nothing super obvious about him. So, of course, underneath that, there's a lot, right? There's everything that has to do with the hypothalamic dysregulation is really difficult. And, you know, we're lucky that we have him on oxytocin, and that seems to help with regulating his appetite and his weight and those kinds of things. But, of course, all the other hypothalamic regulation, those problems are still there. We haven't found any help for that. Unfortunately, the oxytocin does not help him, you know, normalize his temperature regulation and does not give him his thirst. So that thirst problem is still difficult to manage, but it's been better. We seem to kind of have it down now. We have a handheld device that is a loaner to us from a company that they use in hospitals, and we can measure his blood sodium on a regular basis. The machine itself costs about $15,000, and you can't buy it. It's not, it's just something that they use in hospitals and in doctor's offices. But anyway, we have that. So we don't have to run to the lab anymore. You know, whenever we need a test, we can just do that at home. So the DI, the diabetes insipidus, is one of those invisible, you know, pain in the butt things that we have to manage. You know, all the other hypothalamic stuff, you know, the fact that he can't sweat or shiver. One time he had an adrenal crisis, which is a life-threatening crisis that's related to not having stress hormones. And he his rectal body temperature was 87 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh my gosh.
And he was still not, he was not shivering.
Yeah,
and he can't sweat. So it's very hard for him to exercise and to, you know, if he's in temperatures, like we're lucky here in the Bay Area, very mild weather here.
Right.
You know, our winters can get down to, you know, at nighttime in the dead of winter, it can be 25 degrees. I suppose that would be the coldest we have it. And then the summers generally in the San Francisco Bay Area, it doesn't get usually above 80 or 85. But for my son, if it's above 75 or 80, he becomes uncomfortably hot because he can't sweat. So it's very hard to exercise. If you can't sweat, you can't, you know, get overheated.
Right.
So those are some of the struggles, I think, that happen that you wouldn't necessarily know about.
Sure, sure. What are some of your son's favorite activities, sports or the like? Can he do any of that? And how have your family survived during this COVID pandemic?
My son, He does like food a lot still, and he likes, I think I mentioned, he does like to cook. So we are the beneficiaries of his love for cooking because he makes breakfast.
Oh, nice.
Every
nice.
Day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. Yeah. Sometimes it's really good. Like he'll make eggs and bacon. And we're not afraid of fat anymore. So we do eat fat.
Right.
Yeah. And let's see, he also enjoys playing cards. There's a card game that he likes to play called Magic the Gathering. he does a lot of walking and hiking. And he plays guitar and sings. We're a very musical family, so music is a big part of our life.
Nice.
He is going to be graduating from high school this spring, summer, and hopes to work with kids. So that's something that he hopes to do, is to get a job at like a preschool or doing something like that. As a family, we've been super, super lucky during the pandemic, and in general too. We have two teenage kids. So my son's 18 and his sister's 16. They've done okay with distance learning. It's not ideal, of course. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody who says, oh, this is better than learning in school. But, we're really lucky that they're not 4 and 6, for example. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've been able to stay healthy. No one's come down with COVID. We've been able to stay employed while working from home. We just have everything to be thankful for. And probably on top of that, the icing on the cake, I would say, is that I have a lot of hobbies and have been able to do even more of my hobbies because we're staying at home.
Taking away that transportation portion, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, and so I think, the music has been a big saving grace for me. In fact, even today and tomorrow, I organize a socially distant music festival in my town,
nice.
And it's called the COVID Cella, and it's happening today and tomorrow. So I have 43 bands playing over 2 days, and we do it for charity. So we're benefiting 3 organizations in my community that support the arts, and we've done it before for food banks and for other nonprofit orgs like that. So that's actually
great.
Happening today. I'm very excited. My band is
great.
Playing tomorrow.
Oh, okay. That's wonderful.
Great.
I was going to say this will be after the fact, but
yeah.
I'm sure that my mom would love a link so that she can
watch
tune
it.
In if
yeah.
possible.
Yeah.
Because, music will go right to her heart. And both she and Ron are recreational therapists. So you're definitely.
I'll send you some videos. It's
awesome.
A live music festival. That's the funny thing.
That's,
during the pandemic, everyone plays from their driveways and people wear masks and, people watch music, and I have a schedule, and we have lots of great musicians in our town. So
yeah,
send us the link.
And even though the episode won't post for a while, we'll put it on our Facebook.
Absolutely.
Feed.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
Thank you. That's amazing. You're going to end up with inspiring other people to do the like, and my mom will be out in our driveway with the guitar in a matter of minutes.
Awesome.
But before we lose her for that, UTD, what does the future of treatment look like for hypothalamic obesity disease, and what research is currently underway? And then also I was wondering, are smartwatches and the like going to come into play as far as monitoring temperature and fluid intake and things of that nature?
Okay, let me see if I can remember all those questions.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So in terms of future of treatment, mm-hmm. we're feeling much more heartened now compared to 5 years ago when I started the oxytocin experiment for my son. Children's Hospital in Philadelphia is actually in the middle of doing a clinical trial right now. In fact, I think it's wrapping up, and Dr. McCormick is going to be hopefully putting out her published paper soon. She studied treating children and young adults with hypothalamic obesity using intranasal oxytocin. So pretty much the same thing that I've done with my son. So we're waiting for those results. There are other drugs that are coming down the pike. There's one that I can think of right now, new drug that's actually just, so last weekend or last week, there was a the big endocrinology conference called ENDO, which I think is an international conference. This drug did have a, I don't know if they had a poster session, but they were able to present their results. The drug is called Tesamet. And if it is approved, after it goes through all the trials, it will be, according to them, the first FDA-approved drug for the treatment of hypothalamic obesity.
Wow.
So that's going to be going through another set of trials, I believe. And then the last one that is more of a preventative thing is, as I mentioned, if we can do surgery, or if we do treatments to remove the tumor in a less invasive way and prevent the damage altogether to these very precious parts of the brain, then that would be even better. So I learned of a treatment that uses focused ultrasound, and there are probably, I don't think every person would be a candidate for this necessarily. I'm sure it depends on the type of tumor, but there is a surgeon also in Florida, in Miami, Florida, who has used this focused ultrasound to destroy the tumor, which is completely non-invasive and no surgery incisions necessary. And that's something that we're hoping will get developed to help people who get diagnosed with this tumor and other tumors.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, it is. Eugenie, what support have you and your son received during the healthcare journey from your family and friends?
Well, we have a pretty tiny family, you know, probably between my husband and myself. You know, in terms of blood relatives, I would say there's less than 8 people, less
wow.
than 10 people, very, very small.
Can we send you some?
Yeah, I was going to say, we are willing to lend you some.
Yeah, we have a lot. We'll send you some.
Oh, you guys have
yeah.
a big family. Oh, that's,
yes.
I'm always jealous of people with big families. Yeah, we have a really small family. So we're grateful to our family, but they are small, so there's not a lot mm-hmm. of them. And we do have friends, and the friends have been helpful as well. So I would say, you know, we have great family and friends, period. That's great. In spite of having great family and friends, I think it still can be a very lonely journey when you have a condition that nobody else has. You know, mm-hmm. like if I had a common condition and I could, you know, talk to a friend and they would say, oh, I know what that's like. Yeah. Blah, blah, blah. But that is not the case with something like craniopharyngioma. So that is why it's super, super helpful to rely on these online communities that I spoke
mm-hmm.
about.
Mm-hmm.
We also belong to a camp that has met twice a year called Jack's Camp, and it's put on by the pediatric brain tumor group and pediatric, anyway, I can't remember the Pediatric Brain Tumor Society. I'm sorry, I can't remember the name. Anyway, so we go to a camp mm-hmm. that is held over a long weekend, and we meet with other brain tumor families. And that's also been super helpful to us. And then I would say, lastly, this is something that I wanted to give to the community, but I also ended up receiving a lot, which is when I started the blog, when I started the oxytocin experiment with my son in 2016, I had a very sudden idea that I needed to also start a blog.
Mm-hmm.
So I started the blog on July 2nd. After we had been treating him with oxytocin just for a very short period of time, and was writing in it quite religiously for a long time. I have since stopped really writing in it because, you know, it's been quite a while and he's pretty stable now. So, but writing in the blog, and it was also internationally read
mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there is nothing out there really for hypothalamic obesity. But that really helped me a lot too. And I thought, was thinking about it recently, it was sort of like I was writing in a journal and talking about our experiences and our frustrations and, you know, the ups and downs. And it was almost like people reading the blog, it was like they were reading my personal journal. And it was this very supportive feeling, like they're all rooting for us. You know, they
mm-hmm.
wanted us to be successful, and they would show their support by writing comments and ask questions. And it was a strange, very public and very private event all at the same time. So that was really helpful.
Very nice.
Yeah, sorry, I'm gonna.
Oh, Jean's crying. Okay.
I'm sorry.
You got her.
Okay. Well, I was crying earlier too. Okay. I apologize for that. Well, I guess Eugenie, I really want to know, because you've given so much advice in your blog. But what advice do you have for someone who's been recently diagnosed with hypothalamic obesity or for the parents or child of someone with hypothalamic obesity?
What advice would I give?
Yes.
Well, I would definitely give people the advice to join, groups, join online. Probably online is going to be the most easy to find online support groups.
Mm-hmm.
I'm most familiar with the ones on Facebook, but there probably are others that are not connected to Facebook if they're not into Facebook. I just think that, those of us who have struggled with a rare disease, such as hypothalamic obesity, there's a lot of collective wisdom that we possess and that we can share with one another. I think people, who are dealing with the problems have the most skin in the game and are most motivated to find solutions and also to be helpful to one another. I just think that that's really, really important. And then, if people are up for it, if they, want to attend conferences or webinars or read the literature, they can do Google Scholar searches, look for clinical trials. I think the main advice is to not be passive, to not expect that your doctors will have the answers for you. We have learned, through our multiple experiences that the doctors are well-meaning and, but they are limited by their time and they're limited by their exposure. As we were saying earlier, they see their patients for an hour every few months. We live with this problem 24 hours a day, seven days a week. So it's really important to not passively rely on professionals. And if you're going to rely on anybody, rely on the people who are walking the same walk. So that's what I would advise.
That's great perfect advice. Yes. Eugenie, thank you ever so much for joining the show today. I'm sorry we took time out of your band rehearsal time, I'm sure. and we want you to be able to get back
That's
to
okay.
that. Well, how can our listeners learn more about you? This is my turn to try to say it. Craniopharyngiomas and hypothalamic obesity disease.
Well, I think I didn't mention this earlier, but I should say this now, that the result of the result of our oxytocin experiment was successful, and I ended up publishing a case report with the support of my co-authors in a endocrinology journal called the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. And this is the case report on my son's treatment. So that was published. I also published another article that was sort of a letter to the editor to make a comment about the need to think outside the box for the treatment of hypothalamic obesity, since there is no gold standard treatment. And that was really also to help those who are struggling to try to get a doctor to prescribe oxytocin. Most people have been unsuccessful because it's not FDA approved. And there is insufficient research. So I wrote those two articles and they're published. So they can learn more from those specific things that I wrote. Of course, they can go to my blog, Hope for HO. And really, if someone is struggling with the diseases that I've mentioned, I heartily encourage people to get involved with the work of the Raymond A. Wood Foundation. This is the foundation where I am on the board, and we are a small but very mighty foundation. I can say we work very, very hard. I've got so many projects with the Raymond A. Wood Foundation. It's like a part-time job, even though it's a voluntary position. But the Wood Foundation, under the leadership of Amy Wood, who's the executive director and also a mother to a boy with craniopharyngioma, we are working on a lot of projects to help improve the lives of people affected by hypothalamic pituitary brain tumors. So please look that up. That's super
Absolutely.
Helpful.
Well, we're going to put links for that on our website.
Absolutely. Yep.
Thank you.
And Eugenie, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today. And if you have time in the future, we'd love to have you back on the show to talk about PTSD. And PTSD awareness is in June. So if we can get you back before then, it would be great.
I'd love to talk about that. My specialty in psychology is treating PTSD using eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
Jean knows that.
Yes, I have been reading up on
She's been stalking you.
Yeah, see, now I'm I was told I'm not allowed to say that I stalk anyone online. But yes, I'm very excited to talk about that as well.
All right, great. Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed talking to you all about this topic that's very dear to my heart, and I hope that it has helped some listeners.
Oh, for sure.
Absolutely.
I'm sure it will.
Yeah, without doubt.
And if our listeners have any questions or comments related to today's show, they can contact us at podcastdx@yahoo.com, through our website, podcastdx.com, on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, or Instagram.
And if you have a moment to spare, please give us a review wherever you get your podcast. As always, please keep in mind that this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment, or before undertaking a new healthcare regime. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this podcast.
Till next week.